You are listening to Season 6 of Future Ecologies.
Welcome back. Today, we're wrapping up our sixth season with a very special episode. With the help of guest producer Caitlin Kennedy, we're taking you to the Emerald Isle of Ireland and meeting an easily overlooked creature that holds the history of a nation within its shell. From the rise and collapse of heavy industry to a bloody civil war, the riverbeds of Ireland have been witness, and they tell a story of change and possibility stretching far beyond any human lifetime. From Future Ecologies, this is Muscle Memory.
Broadcasting from the unceded, shared, and asserted territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. This is Future Ecologies, exploring the shape of our world through ecology, design, and sound.
These are all the things you need whenever you have a team going out with you. And one of the most important things is your life jacket. Let's go on adventure.
Who lives in a river? Do you know? I certainly didn't. I've explored the coastline, looking for starfish and crabs in rock pools, but I'd never really perused a riverbed. That's all about to change.
Just watch your step. You wouldn't drop into the hole or something.
We're in the Ireland of legend. Green, mossy boulders tumbling down into a fast-flowing river full of tentacle-like ranunculus, which provides endless hiding places for aquatic species. My guide, Frank Mitchell, and I are wearing our life jackets, yes, but also waders up to our chests. As we pick our way down the banks, I imagine diving down and swimming amongst the very creatures we're looking for.
If you come up here, and it's not easy for you to see them, and they're all in there. And if you come on over here...
Frank passes me the batiscope, a traffic cone-shaped instrument with a perspex pane for peering down to the riverbed. When my eyes adjust to the shadow cutting through the surface of the water, there they are, freshwater pearl mussels.
Wow. Oh, God, there's loads of them.
See them in there?
Oh, yeah.
You see them in underneath the bark of the tree? Yeah.
Until recently, I had been oblivious to the existence of any river mussels, but in 2021, I came to the Ballinderry River, which wends its way through the rolling hills of County Tyrone in Northern Ireland. I discovered a species whose existence was so very different to my human life, I became a little obsessed. Their lives are fascinating, a paradox of stillness and flux. But more than anything, I wanted to understand why they're struggling to survive in the rocky streams of Ireland. Frank's life, like those of the creatures he cares for, is deeply entwined with the Ballinderry River. Here, he is responsible for the longest-running freshwater pearl mussel breeding programme in the world.
And I've been here now for the last 30 years.
Frank spent his youth fishing the Ballinderry's dappled banks and building weirs out of sticks near its source.
I was born and reared on the Ballinderry River.
But he never imagined he'd now be working to save another creature that calls the river home, or that it would be the longest-lived creature anywhere in the UK and Ireland. In the time it's taken Frank's hair to turn white, the oldest mussels in his care have grown from less than a millimetre to the length of his hand. And they'll continue growing for some time yet.
And then I realised that I would be actually working on such an interesting and important project with the freshwater pearl mussels.
Every day for the past 3 decades, Frank has arrived at work in his overall and wellies and traversed a bridge over the river. When he opens the door to an abandoned-looking building, he sees the familiar rows of long white ceramic tanks that form a series of water channels through which the Ballanderry River is diverted.
We're walking in a breeding centre where the river's coming through naturally. So we have to keep this clean so that the mussels that are dropping off here get every good chance of surviving in the gravel.
Frank reaches down into one of the makeshift riverbeds and stirs some recently settled sediment back into the flow of the river.
And all I'm doing here is just moving the silk off the gravel, trying to keep it clean. So if you get a look in here, you see all those mussels there?
To my untrained eye, what Frank has pulled out of the water looks like a pebble. In their native habitat of rocky streams, it can be hard to discern them. But these are freshwater pearl mussels. When I say mussel, you might be imagining a small blue-black sea mussel. But these mussel shells are rounder and a matte dark brown colour. They're much bigger than sea mussels and don't latch onto any rocks, just lie burrowed in the riverbed, making them pretty hard to spot. You might see these frilly, pale fronds poking out of the shells when they're feeding. These are the mussel's siphons, sort of an in-tube and an out-tube. One siphon inhales the water from which they'll extract the food they need, and the other releases water and any waste. At that level, not so different from us. Except that in a mussel, they both emerge in the same place. And the same pipes that are used for eating are also used for breathing, and getting rid of waste, and reproducing. Oh, and did I mention that freshwater pearl mussels live for 150 years? Some of the oldest animals on the planet are in fact mollusks, like the record-breaking black quahog clam, who live for up to 500 years. Our Irish pearl mussels might not hold the title, but they're still seriously long-lived, especially for their size. It's mind-blowing to think that there are mussels alive today who were born before the Titanic set sail.
I remember seeing my first mussel when I was a young cub fishing along the river. I didn't know an awful lot about them. It's no real big deal to me. But when you start to work with them and you start to learn about them and how important they are, and then you go to a mussel site, the first mussel site I went to, a real good one, was away down in Donegal and Galway. And when I come across these big, massive sites, it's mind-blowing.
This dense population of mussels in a bend of the river might be a rarity now, but it would have been a commonplace sight to Frank's grandfather. By the 2010s, the mussel population in the Ballanderry had crashed by 90% in little more than a human generation.
I think you would find some freshwater pearl mussels in most rivers in Ireland at one point.
I drove the length of Ireland to meet Dr. Mary Catherine Gallagher, an aquatic ecologist who worked on a freshwater pearl mussel restoration project in County Kerry. It's a rugged coastal region carved up by Atlantic sea lochs in the southwest corner of the island.
They're present in Europe and also globally, so they're a worldwide species. On a global level, they're classified as being endangered, but then on an Irish and European level, they're critically endangered.
In Ireland, populations are clinging on down the west coast, particularly those rocky, hilly places that are harder to farm intensively or build houses on.
From Donegal all the way down to Cork.
But the reason scientists like Mary Catherine have been working with freshwater pearl mussels isn't just because they're endangered. Freshwater pearl mussels are sometimes referred to as an umbrella species. If you make conditions right for them, everyone else in their vicinity benefits, including humans.
They will filter about 50 litres of water a day. That's what an adult mussel can do. So I've seen it written, like, you know, the amount of water for a bath, which is an awful lot. And they're filtering it, and obviously they're doing that so they can get food. But that action also has a cleaning effect on the water. They also can remove pathogens that are harmful to human health as well.
And as they filter all matter flowing through the river, sometimes it can give rise to the very thing that gives these mussels their name.
Some mussels can contain a pearl.
Some, but not many. Pearls aren't a standard part of the mussel's biology. They're an accidental defence mechanism. So despite their name, you're actually only likely to find a pearl inside 1 in 7,000 mussels. Filter feeding mollusks have evolved to prevent large debris from getting trapped inside their shell and irritating the outer layers of their bodies. If something does get trapped, the mussel has an ingenious strategy. It secretes the same substance which lines their shell, gradually coating the object until smooth and rounded.
It's usually some sort of, like, a bit of sand or some sort of fragment that's, like, foreign to the mussel. It's actually almost like a immunological response almost.
Like, yeah. Us producing eye goo.
Yes, exactly, but a lot more beautiful.
This substance is called nacre, or more commonly, mother of pearl, and it catches light with a kind of muted glow of colours. At the microscopic level, highly ordered hexagonal bricks of calcium carbonate tessellate and form layers. When visible light enters, some wavelengths are trapped whilst others scatter, creating a pearlescent effect. Unfortunately, this has brought the mussels a lot of unwanted attention. Throughout recorded history, pearl fishers have scooped these vulnerable mollusks out of riverbeds, opening them up in search of treasure.
And because not every mussel contains a pearl, that could mean hundreds of mussels being taken out of the river, opened up, and if they didn't have a pearl, just being, like, discarded on the riverbank. That's obviously an illegal practice in Ireland now as well.
Even when a mussel lacks its eponymous pearl, the inside of its shell is entrancing to look at. Some shell interiors have gold streaks from iron-rich waters. Some are more pink or blue, depending on the metals nearby. Nacre's a bit of a super substance, being stronger than steel and less brittle than the limestone from which it's made. Material scientists have long tried to replicate nacre's impressive ability to stop cracks from forming in their tracks, a feat achieved by the perfect alchemy of hard calcium carbonate bricks and soft silk-like proteins which hold the layers together. Mussels can even use nacre to glue themselves back together again. If their shells get a little worn, they will simply lay down more layers of nacre, gradually repairing the damage from the inside out. And yet, living mussels never intentionally display this mystical-looking substance to the outside world. What Mary Catherine sees when conducting surveys is two matte black shells kept almost completely shut. But as an ecologist, she's come to appreciate them for far more than their shiny nacre.
You'll see the shells and then you'll see the openings for the siphons, but they're really beautiful, like, especially the inhale and siphon. It has these, like, frilly edges. I think it depends on the situation or on the lighting maybe, but sometimes it's kind of a greyish colour, sometimes it's more of, like, maybe a light pinky kind of colour. And that's all you'll see usually. And then inside it's just, like, yeah, as, like, a soft bodied, gloopy organism.
And what does a gloopy organism encased in a shell need to live its best life?
They like really clean water. They like high oxygen levels. They like what's called this Goldilocks flow. So it's kind of like not too fast, not too slow, a very in the middle kind of flow rate in the river. In terms of the substrate or, like, the river bottom, they like a kind of a diversity, really. They like some kind of bigger rocks and boulders and then some smaller sediments as well. It's nice if the river has little riffles in it, so areas that are really nice and well oxygenated. It can be nice if the catchment has, like, a lake higher up, so that can kind of help to stabilize the flow of water. Low levels of nutrients, they don't like, you know, eutrophic waters. basically clean, medium level of flow, nice diversity in the riverbed, good levels of oxygen.
And fish?
And fish, of course. The fish are really important. I always forget about the fish. I'm so focused on the mussels. But obviously you have no mussels with no fish.
This is the bit about freshwater pearl mussels that completely captivated me when I first learned about them. Because the beginning of their life is just so wildly different to the rest of their very long, very sedentary years. See, a freshwater pearl mussel larva cannot survive without latching on to the gills of a fish.
Just checking on my fish to see how they're doing, and they're doing okay. I'm just going to lift out a fish here, and I'm just going to take a look at the gills of the fish just to see if there's any mussels on them, or they're starting to drop off. This, by the way, doesn't do the fish any harm, okay? No. You're not going to see much, it's very hard to see, but there's a few wee white specks there.
As Frank gently pulls back the little trout's gill cover, I get a glimpse of the white spots he's describing. Really, it just looks like the fish has some goo stuck on its gills. But each globule contains thousands of larvae. And under a microscope, each one looks like...
like a miniature mussel, like a teeny tiny mussel.
These are the lucky few, the ones who beat the clock. Because baby mussels, or glycidia to use their scientific name, have just 24 hours to latch onto the gills of a salmon or trout. After that, they perish. At this stage, they're extremely small, about a third of the size of a grain of sand.
And they're tiny, but they are able to sense when a fish is nearby. So a salmon or a trout in Ireland are the two species that they like to attach onto. They're basically kind of like floating around in the water. When they sense that a salmon or trout is nearby, they actually start opening and closing their shells, so it's called snapping. And if they are lucky enough to be inhaled by the fish and then pass over the gills, and if they happen to snap at the right moment and grab onto the gills, they can stay there for 9 months, and they go everywhere the fish goes.
For quite a long time, I couldn't understand why evolution had resulted in such a perilous obstacle course for the baby mussels. But the more I spoke to Frank and Mary Catherine, the more it made sense. Newly hatched microscopic mussels are at huge risk of predation, so their fish host becomes their mobile shelter. But more crucially, if freshwater pearl mussels dispersed their young just through the water, each population would be washed further and further downstream and quickly into the sort of slow, sediment-laden water they can't tolerate. When they drop off the gills after 9 months, the chances are they'll be roughly in the same place they started, or even a bit further upstream. This is actually quite a common reproduction strategy in river mussels, and some are much more aggressive about it. In the US, pocketbook mussels have evolved a natural lure that looks just like a tiny fish. An adult pocketbook will bait an unsuspecting predator near its open shell and then clamp shut, trapping the fish for up to an hour whilst it blasts the gills with larvae. Our Irish pearl mussels are tame in comparison. Ecologists have battled whether to call this relationship parasitic or symbiotic. It is clear that having mussel larvae attached to your gills does give you a bit of a disadvantage. So infected fish end up smaller than uninfected fish. But in cleaning the river, it's also likely that the mussels create an ideal habitat for fish spawning. Newly educated, I reckoned it was time to try and find some mussels by myself. I'm looking for pearl mussels in this river in Kerry. A word on looking for mussels. You actually have to have a license from the National Parks and Wildlife Service to do what I'm doing because of how endangered these mollusks are. Swimming or fishing, fine-ish. There are some pretty mad laws here about riverbed ownership. But these mussels' habitats are super fragile right now, so please don't go grabbing your nearest batiscope without a licensed professional. Oh. Hello, blackbird. But it's quite tricky here because the rocks are very dark, so they hide the mussels very well. So I'm just looking for signs of them, like a siphon. Definitely no mussels there. Oh, there's some very rapidly moving trout. God, they've got places to go. From what Mary Catherine and Frank said, they like a kind of dappled space. So I'm looking under trees. And it's tricky because whilst I want to get close, I don't want to drop my audio recorder in. There's definitely a lot of trout and water boatmen, but not a lot of mussels.
Yeah, they were at one point really widespread and really numerous. Their range in general over the past few reporting cycles isn't really contracting much, so they can still be quite widespread, but it's the numbers in the populations that are really declining. So we have a lot of kind of like little remnant populations or populations that are sort of functionally extinct. So there's adults there, but they're not managing to reproduce successfully, and there's no juvenile recruitment.
To make sense of this drastic decline, we need to emerge from the surface of the stream and look around at the island visible before us. From this vantage point, we see that the bank has been completely cleared on one side, giving an open view of a field of cows, some ambling down the bank to drink directly from the river. Beyond the field are the Lagan Hills, almost entirely bare except for three perfect rectangles of monoculture pine plantation. The river too has artificially straight lines where it's been channeled. On the other bank, through the boughs of a few small trees, a tractor spreads herbicide on the marshy land, getting rid of the rushes for a field of grazing sheep. My dad grew up in Ireland, so we visited every year. He and I both agreed this view is far from unusual. And it's not just visually a tidied landscape. London's Natural History Museum created a Biodiversity and Intactness Index to measure ecosystem health. The index has since been adopted by the United Nations to tell which countries are most nature depleted. Out of 240 countries on the index, Northern Ireland ranks 13th. From the bottom. The Republic of Ireland ranks only one place above. How did this happen? How did this island come to be so desperately nature depleted? When Frank was growing up in the 1950s, things actually looked pretty different.
To me, those were good days, and the river always seemed healthy and doing well. Spent a lot of my time playing, fishing. Those days, you didn't have money to buy a fishing rod or not.
So older fishermen would give young Frank some bait to tie to his hazel stick, and that kept him happy. Although other forms of life, like mussels, were of little consequence to him.
I remember seeing mussels when I was a cub out fishing, but I never really paid much attention to it. To me, it was just a shell.
There are a few habitat records from the 50s, but mussels were undoubtedly more numerous than they are now.
In my time, and I'm walking with them around 30 years, the profile has lifted well up from the 50s and 60s. Where they really weren't protected, like, I mean, they still had men coming out poaching, looking for these pearls.
Those men would sit in glass-bottom boats to search the riverbed for telltale frilly siphons. From there, they could easily reach in and scoop the large shells out, crack them open, and hope for a pearl. And for every pearl they'd find, at least 5,000 mussels would pay with their lives. But despite Frank's early love of the outdoors, he couldn't have imagined working in nature protection. It just wasn't a job in those days. People in the 50s and 60s still thought of nature as a bottomless resource. Besides, Frank had a humble start in life.
I never had any real big desire to be anything special, you know. My role in life was, because I had no qualification, was to just get a job. Keep out of trouble, keep busy.
At age 15, Frank got a job in the local textiles factory, an incredibly common trajectory for young boys and girls of that era. Everyone in Northern Ireland knows someone who worked in textiles.
Yeah, I mean, I remember making loads of fancy silk shirts, silk trousers, bell bottoms was a big thing in my time here. You loved it.
It's true. Frank and I both have a passion for flashy shirt and snazzy trousers. But the era of opportunity couldn't last forever. And though Frank tried to avoid it, trouble was on the horizon for people and muscles.
We'll pick up this thread when we come back after the break. And we're back. I'm Mendel. This is Future Ecologies, and on today's show, producer Caitlin Kennedy is tracing the modern arc of Northern Ireland through the story of the freshwater pearl mussel.
It's the 70s. Frank is living out his snappily dressed youth in the textile factory, having put aside his love for the river for now. But as we're about to discover, its health will become central to his story, and that of Ireland's freshwater pearl mussels. Textiles, rivers, and the people that work the land are so inextricably linked on the island of Ireland that the Dublin Customs House building, built in the 1780s, features a weathered figure crowned by pearls and wearing a turban of flax plant. This statue is the spirit of the Ban River, and it shows two core tenets of the Irish economy at the time, flax and pearls. This makes sense because in the 18th and 19th century, freshwater pearl mussels were prevalent. They would have been in most Irish rivers and streams in the rocky, fast-flowing upper sections. As evidence, we can find their namesake pearls in folk stories and mythology from across the island. To understand Ireland's past, especially its historic relationship with land and water, I needed to venture back to when storytelling reigned supreme. So I drove to Atha A, near Dublin, on the east of the island, to meet a folklorist by the name of Stefan Cullen.
My name is Stefan. I am primarily a storyteller, also a folklorist.
Had they been born pre-500 BC, Stefan would definitely have held the revered position of celebrated bard. They're a performer through and through. They're also a firm believer that the stories told then shouldn't be sugarcoated to retain relevance in today's world.
There's a few different aspects to the pearl. Well, water in general, rivers, lakes, the sea, wells, they all have strong association with all aspects of folklore because they're a food source, first of all, and they're also dangerous. You shouldn't go out to the water on certain days or go near the water on certain days because the dead will emerge and drag you down, or the fairies will emerge and drag you down. And because of how common it was for people to drown. There's a few stories where children have gone out gathering pearls and then later will commit some kind of transgression, and when they speak, they're not able to form words. All that comes out of their mouth is more pearls. The oldest legal system in Europe, composed by the native Irish people. There are laws in there on what we would call today natural conservation. There are laws on when you can fell certain trees, how many of each kind of tree you can fell at a time, and what the penalties for felling them in the wrong season or at the wrong age would be. There's also similar laws on overfishing, what you take from the water, what you take from rivers and the sea. We've had all of this very extractive agricultural process kind of imposed on us that we now see as the norm. And an important aspect of indigeneity is connection to the land and having a kind of reciprocal relationship with the land.
I found it hard to pinpoint when habitat destruction really started in Ireland. After all, the ancient Picts, Britons and Gaels, they were already clearing forests and draining wetlands well before the Anglo-Saxons arrived. But the pressure on rivers definitely did ramp up with the arrival of the English in the 1600s, and it accelerated with an industrial land use that came to be at the core of Northern Irish identity. Linen textile mills. If you read about Ireland before the Republic gained independence, two things leap out from the annals of history: linen and the famine. Despite England's pivotal role in both, I was actually never taught about either at school. In the 1860s, Ireland was hit by a potato blight that destroyed the staple food of its agricultural workers, killing more than 1 million people in one of the worst famines ever seen in Europe. Many, many more were forced to emigrate. The British still controlled Ireland in its entirety, and their brutal policies of denying aid and forcing export of everything else the country grew really did increase the death toll. So the only thing people had to sell was their land.
A lot of the changes to society happened after the famine.
This is Sebastian Graham, a historian with Ireland Heritage.
Now, we weren't too badly off up here in Ulster with the famine, but in other areas, those rural areas really suffered, and that's why these mills are so important for the rural areas, that they kept people from going off to emigrate. They developed their own community around the place. And after the famine, you had the rapid industrialisation, investing in machinery, plenty of workforce, wages were low, and they could export, you know, quite a lot of their produce.
Sebastian and I meet at one of the last mills in Northern Ireland to cease production, closing down in just 2015. Approaching through the woodland that has quickly encircled the red brick buildings, you can hardly tell this was a hive of industry. But Sebastian tells me that 180 years ago, this mill would have been as loud and bustling as the cities it provided for.
So we're in Upperlands, which is a historic mill village just outside Macará in County Londonderry. It was one of these mill villages that sprung up in the 1700s, where you could have a job in a mill, you'd have your terrace house, you would have your school, you'd have everything real close to you.
In a feat of cartography not seen since sea monsters inhabited the earth, Sebastian has mapped all 4,500 mills across Northern Ireland.
There's bloody mills everywhere.
As we walk towards the old abandoned mill, we're surrounded on all sides by woodland that has sprung up in the past 10 years as nature reclaims the site, populated by swallows, swifts and small mammals who've made their homes in the remnants of the mill.
Isn't that amazing?
Big old lake.
Big, big lake. So again, like, this landscape looks natural, but it's completely man-made. There were no lakes here at all, and it was just essentially created to power the mills.
We pause at an Art Deco facade, which must have been an entrance to the new mill. It's a picture of faded grandeur, with 1929 emblazoned into the masonry. Sebastian told me that the 1920s marked the peak of linen's desirability, especially for England's upper class. Think crisp white linen suits and tennis attire worn on holiday in the French Riviera. This building would probably have heralded a glamorous age of mechanised progress as the mill clothed London's elite. I follow his gaze to the side of the clock and spot two flared sheaths of linen textile, like the tassels on fancy curtains.
I just love these linen swags. You know, you see that in a lot of buildings in Belfast. So cool the way they've incorporated that here.
Linen.
Yeah, it's like a plaster motif. You get them in a lot of those 20s, 30s buildings, you know. The flax floor is actually the symbol for Northern Ireland. But no one really knows that anymore because the industry's dead and buried.
Later on a walk, I find the real deal growing at the edge of a field. Flax is a beautiful plant. It has a long straight stem and periwinkle blue flowers with 5 rounded petals that coalesce round a yellow centre. But according to Sebastian, in contrast to the plant, the process of manufacturing linen was not pretty at all.
For linen manufacture, you pull it from the field and then you put it under water for about 14 days. And that's the retting process.
Retting is a kind of fermentation that separates the tough, woody exterior of the plant from the supple, desirable fibres within. But the water left behind is
the most smelly, horrible stuff. scientifically, there's wee bacteria changing the whole nature of the plant. But unfortunately, a lot of the flax ponds release that water back into the rivers. And we're not talking one or two farms, we're talking about 70% of farmers at the time in the 1800s doing it.
This deoxygenated, alcohol-rich slough spelled disaster for river dwellers. The pearl mussels filtering this toxic liquid would have struggled, but so would the fish they depend on for reproduction.
Because of the fact that it's deoxygenated, that'll just kill everything out for miles downstream. The bleaching of linen would have also had a detrimental impact too.
As linen supply and demand ballooned, the pressure on rivers increased. And although drinking water was affected as well, and measures were brought in to prevent the worst toxic releases, little was done to enforce them. Then came two world wars, and linen was needed for everything. Parachutes, cords, uniforms, bags, you name it, it contained linen.
I think when Churchill stated about without linen, there would have been no victory. Even the king and queen, they had part of their land in Sandringham dedicated to flax growing because it was needed in, you know, massive quantities for just everything you can think of, really.
The war might have been won on linen, but it would also be its downfall. Huge technological leaps brought in the age of plastic.
Sometimes I think you love nylon better than you do me.
The two loves of my life.
In style, they're a classic, but they're made of the latest thing, woven, texturized polyester.
To look neat in the fall, look for Dacron on the label, because Dacron is a man's best friend. A man looks so smart in suits that are able to stay wrinkle-free and neat. In winter cold and winter sleet, a man's at his best when he looks well-dressed, wearing suits that have Dacron in the blend. And the colors and styling will sure keep him smiling. Dacron is a man's best friend. Thanks to Dacron,
my new arms.
So by the time Frank was 15 and off to work, textile manufacturing was still the main source of employment, but increasingly the factories were working with rayon, nylon and polyester. But though linen bleaching and retting was in decline across these lands, the creatures of the river were far from safe. After the war, Britain and Ireland went into agricultural overdrive. The pressure was on to rebuild and regrow. The post-war farming intensification was actually going to be the mussels' biggest threat yet. I feel like Ireland today is a microcosm of what has gone wrong with our relationship with the land. Overly intensive agriculture and forestry have put productivity over planetary capabilities in so many parts of the world. There's a disconnect between people, intact habitats, and the cultural knowledge which once tied us all together. It can make it quite hard to trace the origins of ecological harms. So when I asked Mary Catherine what has impacted the mussels most, I was actually surprised to hear that the biggest problem they face aren't the usual river pollution culprits of chemicals and excess nutrients, although these definitely don't help. It's sediment from soil erosion.
Yeah, so there's like a bunch of different reasons. You might have livestock entering a river, and that activity and like the trampling within the river will cause sedimentation. Then there are things that are happening on the land. So, for example, if you have too many animals stocked in a field, they're going to overgraze, they're going to create poaching and areas of bare soil. And then when you have periods of rainfall, that sediment is just going to flow into the river.
In other words, the very thing mussels need to filter feed is killing them because there's just so much of it in rivers. Adults are hardier. They can generally survive and expel a lot more sediment. But the fragile young mussels, they're essentially suffocated by over-sedimentation.
We have problems as well with river bank management. So, you know, these lovely, beautiful, like riparian zones that you get along a natural river that hasn't been disturbed or altered, we often lose them when we start to use land for other things. you know, of course, as a farmer who's trying to make money off of your land, you want to maximise the amount of area. And so often these buffer zones or riparian zones can kind of get smaller and smaller and smaller, or maybe sometimes not exist anymore at all. And that's a problem because obviously all this lovely vegetation along the riverbank is like a natural buffer. And so even if there was sediment running off the land, it would get intercepted at that point and not as much of it would end up in the river.
Replanting riverbanks with a buffer zone of plants is often the first line of defence in river restoration, and it works really well. But it will only ever be a band-aid without less intensive agriculture and forestry practices, ideally that are timed to the rhythm of the rain. If you're thinking this sounds like a gloomy outlook or a never-ending list of implausible conservation demands, you're right. Things weren't great for organisms that called the Irish rivers home. They're still not. But for the Ballenderry pearl mussels, hope came from an unexpected place. The aftermath of a war. Ireland might be known for its rolling hills, welcoming pubs, and a certain joviality known as the crack. But there's a darker side to Irish history. The potato famine, of course, looms large. So too do the troubles, which sowed deep seeds of division that still exist today. And if habitat restoration seemed unlikely in the 70s and 80s, peace felt an even more distant prospect. I know I'm not the first to point out that the Troubles is kind of a diminishing term for what was in fact a civil war, replete with checkpoints and bombs and paramilitaries. This bloody conflict between Catholics and Protestants was fought not only on religious grounds, but also national identity. The Unionists, who were largely Protestant, wanted to stay part of the United Kingdom, whilst the Republicans, largely Catholic, wanted the North to rejoin the South as a fully independent Ireland. The Troubles have been simmering ever since the Republic had gained independence in 1921. But by the 80s and 90s, things turned really ugly. Around 3,500 people lost their lives in bombings, fires, attacks, and reprisal killings. And even people like Frank, a hippie at heart with no interest in stoking the fire, couldn't help getting caught up in the heat.
No, my time, I never really taken any one side of anything because I kind of neutral and all these things.
But because the textile industry was still so dominant at the time, it was inevitable that this all-pervasive social conflict bled onto the factory floor.
Tit for tat. So when you were walking in a factory with 300 or 400 people, whenever something happened, you could have felt the tension. Because as far as they were concerned, I was some way involved because I was the other side of the house. You didn't know when things were going to break out and get worse. The younger generation don't know about these things and they don't want them to know about it.
But in the early 90s, amidst all this distrust and violence, an unlikely alliance formed between Protestant and Catholic anglers. Both were starting to get worried about the state of the Ballenderry River.
The Ballenderry was one of the best fishing rivers in probably the whole of Ireland. And then it started to decline, the number of fish started to fall back.
When I first came to Ballenderry, I had no idea that the freshwater pearl mussel breeding programme actually came into being because of the Troubles. A community whose bonds had been pushed to breaking point came together for the sake of the river.
It was very much based on the two sides of the community working together, and we are always open for anyone to come from our breeding centre to our river school, and it doesn't matter where you're from, who you are, what colour you are, what races you are, anyone at all.
Frank told me those inspiring anglers worked together to access peace and reconciliation funds from the EU, and they carved out a long-term vision of connection to nature in the very building where our story started, the Mussel Nursery. Initially constructed as a fish hatchery, it was soon dedicated to repopulating the river with mussels and studying their long and convoluted lives. To hear Frank and his team advocating for these beings is to hear the healing of old wounds, between Protestants and Catholics, humans and the land.
We were one of them species that can't speak for themselves, so I feel that working with them and having the opportunity to talk about them and raise their profile in any way at all that will help them, William, I'm privileged to be doing it.
The Ballanderry Rivers Trust continues to protect the river. They bring in people of all ages to connect with these species, and they stay true to their reconciliation roots. Before Frank and I ventured out to see mussels in the wild, he had just finished a school tour with students from a Catholic, a Protestant, and an integrated school all at the same time. It's how they always work.
That is something I find when they do that. It's things that will stay in their mind and they have that imprint there. And when you see the children going through the breeding centre and seeing these things and shooting, getting excited, it's just wonderful.
I'm left wondering whether maybe, just maybe, freshwater pearl mussels and the people who protect them can show us a more stable, long-term vision of nature restoration. One where we get better at putting aside differences in beliefs for the sake of species on the brink. If Northern Irish Protestants and Catholics can come together for the sake of the river's health straight after the most turbulent and violent period in their region's history, then there's a lot more hope out there than the news would have us believe. Frank and the team at Ballanderry, they're not engaged in attention-grabbing conservation. Their goals can't be achieved within an election cycle because that's just never going to work for an ultra-long-lived species like the mussels. What he showed me was a truly long-term vision of regeneration based on dedication and perseverance in a deeply challenging context, not waiting for the winds to change first. Because when we spend time with more than human beings or take shared responsibility for their protection, it's pretty special. Frank has probably spent more time than anyone with freshwater pearl mussels, and they've changed him, changed how he sees his role in life. Even just noticing aquatic species whilst I stand up to my knees in a river is a mind-shifting experience.
And then if you come here and look through the bathyscope, and I'll move things gently across, and if you look in there, you'll see the mussels in beneath the weed.
Wow. There's so many in there.
Yep. And sometimes I'm marking where the old mussels are. Why are they there in the first place? They're there because this is where they want to be. Just because I'm walking with them so long, it's nice to see them. But if you can imagine you've put something out here, you've actually reared that on the gills of a fish in the hatchery, and you let them grow on, and then the next thing you go in and you start harvesting them, and you bring them down through the hatchery to grow them on, sort them out, and then you have to tick them and put them in here. Then you come back here in 78 years' time and they're still here. That, to me, is magic.
I've always found wading in a river magical, but now I see every riverbed in a whole new light. I see them as homes to a network of interdependent, fascinating species that are absolutely worth saving. Frank showed me how to glimpse into this realm, and now I do it everywhere I go. And I found a mussel. Oh, and it's a whole little collection of them. And they're really big. These ones must be at least 50 years old. They're nestled in amongst underneath a rock, so they're really, really hidden. I could just tell it because there's a split apart and I can see their little fronds are out, they're feeding. You can see the kind of frilliness. They look very happy and there they will stay for the next, another 50 years.
oh, this is so exciting. I'm thrilled to have found some by myself. Oh, and another one. Oh, what a fantastic end to the day. But I will put my hydrophone in and see whether we hear any sounds.
This episode of Future Ecologies was produced by Caitlin Kennedy and me, Mendel Skolsky, with help from Fiona Glenn. It featured the voices of Frank Mitchell, Mary Catherine Gallagher, Stefan Cullen, and Sebastian Graham. Music by Ollie Keane, Thumbug, Martin Ostrich, Sorsha Kennedy, and our theme by Sunfish Moon Light. Cover art by the wonderful Ale Silva. Future Ecologies is an entirely independent, listener-supported podcast, and it simply would not exist without our incredible patrons. If you'd like to become one and get early episode releases, exclusive bonus content, free and discounted merch like stickers, patches, and toques, plus access to our community Discord and book club, you can sign up at futureecologies.net/join. We'll be back before too long with Season 7, and a few special treats in the meantime. Till then, thanks for listening.